Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Christopher Rose. The word horde has entered the English lexicon with a negative connotation, conjuring up images of warriors on horseback, sweeping across the plain, a virtual human flood destroying everything in its path and then receding, leaving a wave of destruction and grief. Such is often the popular perception of the Mongol Empire under Genghis Khan and his successors, who came to control much of Eurasia in the mid-13th century. In the past few decades, scholarship has started emphasizing other aspects of the 300-year Mongol project. After all, waves of destruction don't also tend to be referred to by names like Pax Mongolica or the Mongolian Peace. Marie Favreau's new book focuses on the northern Mongol Empire, popularly known as the Golden Horde. The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World, is a magnificent, beautifully written study, easily accessible to non-specialists, that seeks to reintroduce the Jochid Empire, the Golden Horde, to world history and to re-examine its impact and legacy. Marie Favreau is associate professor at Paris-Nanterre University. Here's my interview with her. Marie Favreau, welcome to the New Books Network. It's tradition to begin by asking our guests to talk about themselves, where they're from, their background, and what led them to become interested in their field of study. Have you always been interested in Mongol history?
Yeah, first of all, hi, Chris. Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me. I discovered the topic of, you know, the Mongol Empire and Mongolian studies quite late, actually. I was almost in PhD. So first of all, I'm French from Paris, and I did my undergrad in Paris La Sorbonne, and then my master's studied there too. And I was studying history, especially Middle Ages. I was very interested in the medieval period, and I was also studying Arabic language and Russian language. And if you put all this together, then you, in a way, come to the Islamization of Russia, this kind of topic. And I thought I would do my PhD on the Islamization of Russia, and I start reading book on the on the what we call the Golden Horde, so the western part of the Mongol Empire, and on Islam and the process of Islam in Russia, and I discovered a whole new topic I was never told about, the Mongol Empire and the impact of the Mongols on the Russian history. It was so new and so fascinating for me. So it started then, and also I would like to have that. I wanted to use my skills in Russian and Arabic. So the idea also was to combine my interest in history, specifically like late Middle Ages period, and my interest in language. So I wanted to work on, you know, these specific sources. So that's how it started.
Okay. So your first book was about the relationship between, as you mentioned, what's known as the Golden Horde, or as you inform us in your book, the Ulus Jochi, and the Mamluk Sultanate in Egypt. What led you to write a book like this that's much broader in scope?
Yeah, well, there were different steps. So first, because my interest was the Golden Horde and Islam, I went to different countries for archive works and researchers, and because I wanted to meet with foreign scholars. So I went to Russia, and I also went to Central Asia and to Egypt, where I spent actually 4 years. It was my first job after the PhD, my first postdoctoral job. And there I realized that this slave trade network, so this connection between the Mongol Empire and the Mamluk Sultanate, so Egypt and Syria, was extremely interesting and was a very fruitful topic, but I really wanted to understand better the organization of the Golden Horde and the organization of the wide Mongol Empire. So I had the opportunity to work in Leiden with great scholars there who were all working on different empires. But most of these empires were, we can say, perhaps sedentary empires, like the Habsburg, or even Islamic, like late Islamic empires. And I realized that I think like comparative history is extremely interesting and difficult at the same time. I mean, technically speaking, it's difficult because you have to find a common language, you have to find common concept. But also it helped me to understand that I needed more tools to understand my own empire, like the Mongol Empire, and specifically the nomadic part of the Mongol Empire. And I was not really able to understand the nomadic institution in the empire, because I was still using at that time concepts that were developed for sedentary empire, or let's say agrarian empires, like for the Roman Empire up to the Ottoman Empire. And those concepts are extremely interesting, but they're not so useful for the nomadic empires, I think. So I felt a little bit blocked in my research. And then I was extremely lucky because I was offered to work in a big European project called Nomadic Empires, based in Oxford, and was led by Pekka Hamalainen, who's an Americanist and who works on the Comanche and the Lakota empires. So with him and my colleagues there, who were all specialized on different nomadic, you know, organizations in history, I start working on different institutions and on different approach even of the notion of empire. And that's where everything really starts for me. That was in 2014, 2015. And I decided to really change completely my approach of the Mongols then.
Okay. So the historian in me is fascinated by this book. It's very expansive. It's very clear. It's very beautifully written, especially for a history monograph. And I have to ask, tell me about the source material that you used to compile such a vast project. It's really impressive, the amount of material that you cover in this book.
Well, thank you. Well, it's true. Also, I mean, because I started already doing my PhD, this, you know, in a way, project of gathering the sources of the Western part of the Mongol Empire, I had, you know, in my, gathered so many documents already that I felt actually I was really ready to write. I liked mainly the analytical concept. That was the second step, the one, you know, on what I worked on in Oxford. But for the sources themselves, first I gathered all the direct, what I would call the direct sources, the direct production of the Mongols, though in the West. So many administrative documents, coins, inscriptions, everything that was produced directly by the state or by the Mongol chancellery. And the first important thing to understand is that they were not specifically in Mongolian language. So because it was an empire, the Mongols really very early on were open to the language of their subject. So they were hiring people in their chancery to produce documents in the languages of their subject. So for the Horde, it means documents produced in Russian, also in Latin, Persian, Turkic, of course, also. So the idea was really to gather all those documents and then to compare them because they, they show a vocabulary that is probably Mongolian, but most of all, that is it's a imperial vocabulary, imperial terminology, imperial administrative terms that you will find in all those documents. So, like, you know, things related to tanga, the seal, also the tax on trade. This word you will find even in Italian and Persian documents or Russian. So, this work on the language was the first work I've done, and it was really long and but also very interesting. That's one thing. The other thing is, when you work on the Mongols, I think it's really important to open up to other kind of documentation, and I mean here like object archaeology. Even if I'm a historian by formation and really, really historian, I really wanted to have archaeological reports done by colleagues, Russian colleagues mainly. I wanted to read their publication. I wanted to see archaeological sites. So seeing the landscape also, realized that was extremely important. So that is also really part of my documentation. And it's important because it gives you, you feel closer to the nomads also, to the way they live. When you see the landscape, when you see the object they have in their burials. So the human side of history is very important too. So at the end, I was open to any kind of new, materials. And I would say that also if you, in my book, what I use a lot is coins, coinage. But I use it probably not only for, you know, economic history. I think it's very interesting to use coins for religious history, for politics too. I really try to use coins in my way. And the Mongols left, so many, thousands and thousands of coins. So I thought that it was very important to take this into account as well. Yeah. So the way I worked on this project. So try to be, open on, all these different kind of sources. And when I can't read them, I'm not really at ease with Persian language, for instance. And I worked also with colleagues who helped me, and we compared with, other documents. There's a collective aspect in this work, clearly. I mean, when you work on this kind of topic, you work with very closely with colleagues all around the world. And it's also very important for me.
Yes. In your introduction, you propose the idea of the Mongol exchange as a term to describe what historians have often referred to as the Pax Mongolica. And I think that many of our readers will be familiar with Janet Abulogid's work Before European Hegemony, which was one of the first sort of mainstream works to really promote the idea of this era of relative stability during the period from the mid-13th to the mid-14th century, when much of Eurasia was under Mongol control. So What is the Mongol exchange as you conceive of it, and why do you prefer it as a unit of analysis over, say, Pax Mongolica?
Well, yeah, that's an important point in my book. So the thing is, first, I work with the a more common term for this period, which is Mongol peace, Pax Mongolica. It's, you know, the way we are used to describe this century of fruitful exchanges. I mean, not only fruitful exchanges, but I mean, at least trade energy, and it's more than that, even exchange in terms of, you know, knowledge and technologies, and sadly also in disease too. And so I, the point was, when you work on Mongol peace, you use the term Mongol peace, and you have to explain that the Mongols were not specifically at peace among themselves at that time. And also something that is important, I think, is that we tend to see imperial history as, okay, first step, conquest. Second step, administration and organization. While in fact, actually, for the Mongols, not only for the Mongols, probably, but it's all mixed. So they start the conquest. The conquest would last for more than a century. So it's a very, very long process over 3-4 generations. And during the conquest, they also organize, administrate. So it's all, it goes together. So I didn't like the idea of the Mongol peace, because the idea was like, okay, after the conquest, there's peace, which is not clear. When you look at the sources, there are still, you know, a lot of, you know, small wars here and there, like tensions on the frontiers. So it's not really appropriate. And also, I tried to understand how the Mongol envision the peace. What is peace for them? What is, you know, a peaceful state of things? And it's clearly their order. So the idea for them is when subjects accept their economic, political, spiritual order, well, then there's peace in a way. So I realized that the important aspect was more the submission to the Mongol order and the submission to their economic order as well. So I came up with this idea of exchange. It was already there because several colleagues I have in mind, of course, now Timothy May in his book on the Mongol Empire and the Mongol conquest in world history, developed already the idea of Genghis exchange. It was there in other books under the probably the term of like Mongolian or Mongolian exchange. But so it was there already. So I decided to keep it because it was it helped me to understand that what the Mongol created, this big, huge economic and political and spiritual order, was much bigger than the empire, that it lasted longer and it reached countries that were not in the Mongol Empire, just like Western Europe, for instance. Western Europe was involved in the Mongol exchange, but not in the Mongol Empire, you see. So it was very interesting to use a term that could help us to understand that there was a difference between what the Mongol created, launched as an, you know, order or a form of globalization, and the state they created, which, you know, it's they both were connected, but they are not the same. So that's why I came up with this idea of the Mongol the Mongol exchange. And in my book, what is very specific and different from other books on the Mongol empire and its you know, economic reach, is the fact that I focus on the north, and I show that the northern part of the Mongol empire was leader in this big Mongol exchange phenomenon. So that also, I felt free to develop my way of thinking, my own tools of analysis. When I left, you know, this term of Mongol peace, like Pax Mongolica, you know, behind. And this is also something I worked on with my colleagues from the nomadic empires, and decided that we really have to reflect on the terms we use, and we be free to, you know, use new terms as soon as we, you know, explain them. And it's, I think they are good tools for debates also with colleagues.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the fact that you are focusing on the north, which is the section of the Mongol state that was controlled by Ulus Joci, which they called Orda, or as we know it, the Horde, you describe it as being a power of a new kind. And so I have a two-part question here. One is, how so, when we describe it as a power of a new kind, what was new about it? And then the next question is that what have historians traditionally missed or perhaps not fully appreciated in the way that they have approached it and described it in the past?
Well, yeah, that's of course a crucial point for my research. I mean, this book is titled "The Horde," and it's not by chance. The thing is, the term itself, under, you know, the shaped like order or do, was invented much earlier than, you know, the Mongols. It was used before by the Khitan, but even much before by the Turks, and even before we see it in the Chinese sources for the Han, early Han period. So the term was there, and it was connected to a different form of nomadic organization. The thing is, for long, historians focused on the military aspect of the nomadic organization, because I think that in the sedentary sources produced, for example, by the Chinese or by the, you know, Persian secretaries, the nomads were, you know, always on the military side, never really on the administrative side or literate side of you know, societies, which is their point of view. And I think I really wanted to deconstruct that. I think that the Mongols and the nomads were very, very good in organization. They were really able to organize complex, you know, governments, chancery states, on the back of their horses in a way, or in their tents. But I mean, you don't need to be an urban, you know, citizen to think the states and to shape state organization. So that's and in connection with Horde, so the term itself was translated often as, you know, military camp or military headquarter. But when you dig into the sources, you realize that it was often connected to like the women households, large camp organization, administration. So then you come up with a very different idea what a horde, order, ordo was. So of course, it depend on the powers. Like for the Khitan, it was a little bit different, but for the Mongols, clearly the horde means a very complex set of organization of institutions, and it was not only connected to the military, to the military organization. So I realized this, and then I and things became really clear then when I understood that for the Mongols, the Horde was the real the Han city, so like the capital, that the main city, that the center of their state and organization or empire was not the you know, sedentary city in a way, but the mobile one, and that's a Horde. So This is really something that helped me to understand their organization and to understand the way they moved as well. So the fact that the nomads are mobile, fine, we all know that. But in how are they? I mean, is this a different kind of mobility? Is it the same as, you know, the one the sedentary rulers had, because we know that sedentary rulers moved a lot. So so it was very interesting for me to work on mobile institutions of the Mongols, developed by the Mongols. And then I realized how seasonal they were, you know, how they moved. So I work on their movement, how they predictable the court was in its movement, like going, you know, north along the river, especially the Volga River, during summertime, and how they would go south during wintertime. And it gives you an idea of, you know, the seasonality of the empire and on the way they govern and the way they move. So they don't move like everywhere, and it's like it's very organized. So my idea was to deconstruct this concept of horde, the way we are used to, understand it today, like, you know, disorganization, violence, you know, bunch of people. Well, I came up with the other way around, like the contrary. No, it's extremely organized. It's not violent inside. It has to be really peaceful and extremely, you know, a lot of discipline. It's not only about an army. It's also very much about administration, a craftsman, religious man. I mean, you know, women and children. So I came up with a different, very different story. And then I didn't expect that, really, honestly. The other thing I would like to say is it's funny because the term itself, although we know it existed before in the East, in the West, and even in Russia, it really appeared in the sources in the 13th century. So when the Mongol came, the eyewitnesses kept the word horde. So in Latin, in Russian, in Persian, in Arabic, it's all over the place. And they didn't translate it. They didn't try, really. Sometimes they try to explain a little bit, but usually they keep it. And that's, I was fascinated by that. I was like, oh, wow, it's for them too. For those sedentary eyewitnesses, they see it as a new form of, you know, kind of power, a new form of organization. And they don't have a word to say it. So to translate it into, so they keep horde. And I thought that was really, really fantastic. Yes, to see that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think one of the most striking things about the section where you're describing this mobile encampment is exactly what you've been talking about is the organization and the fact that no matter where the settlement would appear, it was organized exactly the same. So it would have the same layout, things would be in the same place. So it would be new landscape, but very familiar. And I think that's something that we don't necessarily appreciate when we think about the Mongols or even any sorts of nomads, because at points you compare them to other nomadic societies, even Native American societies, and I think we just don't think about those sorts of things when they're popularly discussed. Part of the unique character of the Horde was the way that it descended from the early Mongol state that was established by Chinggis Khan, which was not only unique at the time, but the Horde was also unique among the four Ulus that his empire was divided between. So how did the Horde develop into the state that it eventually became?
Well, that's a very important point too. And that's also a very complex question, in fact, because in my work, I had two ideas that were very, that I, you know, kept going back to when I was writing. One is that the Horde is really part of the Mongol Empire, and that this vision we have of the Mongol Empire separated into four, sometimes five parts can be misleading, and it can be sometimes because the Mongols conceived themselves as part of the whole. So even if they are at war, if they are in, you know, they are conflict, it's the same world and there are, you know, common rules. And I really wanted to show that in my book. But at the same time, there are some, you know, specific aspects in the Horde, in the north, in this Jochid regime. So the Jochid, the name that we give to the ruling family that, you know, governed the Horde for three centuries. So if we think about what is different, you know, the distinctiveness of the Horde, if you compare with the other parts, I would say that the first thing that comes to my mind now is really the location, the fact that the ecology of the area. So the fact that they had, the Jochid had to move from what is Mongolia today to Western Russia, Northwestern Russia. This migration is a key thing because it will explain how they have to develop differently, why they have to adapt themselves, how. So then, yeah, that's the first starting point. And I think it's really, it explains why, in the Horde, the Jochid, the Mongols there rule differently than in the south of the Mongol Empire, like China, if you want to speak in modern terms, and Iran today. So it was different because it was the north. And their frontiers also with the sedentary population was different. So they were in direct contact with Eastern and Central Europeans. They had a lot of contact with Italians, with even French and also Northern European peoples, German peoples. And so this specific European frontier also explain why the Horde had to develop, you know, different ways. That's one important thing. And also, they were more trade-oriented than the other Mongols. There are different reasons that I can explain that. So if I can, you know, explain very briefly, one is that they could not rely on agrarian productivity. So if you compare with China and Iran, the production, agrarian production, so the grain production was not the same in the north. So they had to combine with other sources of revenue, of income. So that's one explanation. Also, the climate was very different. So the connection when it's very cold and there's snow or when there's mud in spring are not the same. They're not so always easy. So they don't have the same connection. And the Mongols in the Horde really lived next to the Russian principalities, but not really close, very, very close to them. They're not they don't really have this very direct way of governing that they developed in the country in the East, in China or, you know, or in the Iran, Azerbaijan region. So they developed their own ways. And I argue in my book that this explains why probably this regime, the Jochid regime, the Horde regime, lasted longer, because actually they had, they were less, you know, present, you know, in everyday life for Russian, you know, peasants. The Mongols were not, you know, were not there. So they had, you know, enough space to organize themselves, you know, not too close to their sedentary subjects. And that's clearly, you know, helped the good relation that they were able to develop with especially with the Russian citizens, but also with, you know, other subjects like Italians and Armenians and others. So it was differently organized. So I would say it's all, it's like almost a second point, these technologies of governance that were different and more, you know, in a way indirect than in the South. And finally, I think that the way also, well, that's something that is still, in a way, not a question, but it's a very, very interesting. The fact that they developed, they let's say that the rulers in the Horde converted to Islam really early on. I mean, the first Mongol ruler converted to Islam was Berke, Jochid Khan, and it was already in the mid-13th century. So it was very early on. But they were able still to maintain a very good, you know, balance with the other religious communities in their territories in the West. So they had very good relationship with the Christians. And when I say Christians, you know, I include Orthodox Catholics, like missionaries, Franciscan and Dominican missionaries. They were also Armenians. They also had good relationship with the Jewish communities based mainly in Lower Volga and Crimea. And they really found, were able to find a good balance, you know, and not, we don't see so many religious clashes. In fact, that's interesting. In the Horde territories, and they were also very early on tried to find kind of middle ground between Islamic theory of power or Islamic, you know, everyday life organization and Mongol or nomadic ways of, you know, organizing, you know, everyday life or sense of property and stuff like that. So this combination they were able to make between Islam and Mongol way of, you know, doing it's kind of, first of all, it's the first, it's the earliest attempt to do that, to combine them, two approaches of, you know, society, but it was quite successful in a way, and much successful, much more balanced, much more peaceful than in the Ilkhanate in the south. So, and this it's hard to explain like in a few words, but if you look at, you know, how the process of Islamization, it was like a very long and, you know, process. So they didn't force conversion or stuff like that. It's not at all the way they governed. And so the fact that, you know, they developed this politics of toleration, religious toleration, also for pragmatic reasons and everything, is also very specific. And I mean, it's specific to the Mongols, but it worked very well somehow in the Horde, in the West, and much better than in the South of the empire. So that's, yeah, the other, I think, distinctive point, yes. And, yeah, well, I think now also that, as to conclude on this, what is very specific with the Horde is the way they developed the northern connection in Eurasia, the way they integrate Siberia into the global Eurasian network of exchange. I think that worked also. That was really something extremely impressive to see, and that also they benefited also from the difficulties the Mongols had in the south with the maritime trade routes, internal conflicts in the Ilkhanate. When the Mongols in the south had troubled with the southern routes, well, then the Mongols in the north were able to develop the northern routes. So that's also something very specific to the Horde.
And I think one of the things that very much comes across, and you've alluded to it here, is that the success of the Horde came about, as you put it, not in spite of their nomadism, but because of it. As you mentioned, they're living apart from the sedentary population and sort of only intervene when they have to, but otherwise things are just sort of left without, constant control and oversight, which seems to have eased the relationship there somewhat.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The way the nomads control, the way they do it, the way they control territory, the way they control people is very interesting and very specific to them. The fact that even if they live apart, they know each other. So the Mongols, for instance, ask if we really focus on the Horde, the Khan there would ask the Russian princes to come and visit the Khan's court, the ruler's court, often, and the Russian princes would stay months, sometimes years, at the Khan's court. So there's this idea that they need to meet face to face. They need to know each other like really closely. But at the same time, there are also moments when, it's seasonality. They don't need to, be together all the time. They don't need to send Mongol envoys to the Russian principalities, for instance, all the time. Just at some point, certain moments, they come to the Russian cities. But it's really fascinating to see how they exert their control. So the control is there. They know that they are the master, and they know how to remind their subject that they are the masters. But they are also supple, and they also rely on agreements, negotiations, discussions, exchange, really very much. I don't know if I have to recall this, or to underline this, but they were always outnumbered. I mean, if you compare with this subject, the Mongols are thousands and sometimes a million of warriors, but most of the time they are really less, and less people. If you look at the nomadic side, if you compare with the peasants and with the cities, but they have their way to, show themselves, surprise people, they use surprise, and also they understand extremely well the landscape. They understand geography very well. They know where what I call doors are, or gates for trade. So it can be like a bridge over a river, or checkpoints. It can be like a Detroit straits between two seas. So they know where they have to show themselves, or the places that must be controlled directly and all the time. But for the rest, they don't feel that they need to be there all the time, or they don't have this notion of, how can I put that? Like, the way they own the land in a way, but it's not like, private properties neither. It's a very different approach of, of the land. And I really try to explain that in the book. And yeah, so at the end, I think that's where it's important to remind you know, the reader that these remain nomads until the end, and that's how they build their powers, you know, by using not only mobility, but the way they develop the control of, you know, populations and, you know, lands and territories and, you know, travels, also routes, how they controlled routes, also how they provide protections in, you know, some places, how they open up, you know, trade gateways for some people, close them when they want, you know, this. And this is not specific to the Mongols. This is something I really rely when I work with other people working on, you know, other forms of nomadic powers and organizations. And it's really something that the Mongols are good at. I mean, nomads, sorry, are good at, you know, controlling, you know, not being everywhere all the time, but they, it looked like they are everywhere at the same time all the time. So it's very interesting to read that in the sources, how they impressed the sedentary by, you know, their mobility, how they are swift and quick, and you don't grasp them, you don't know where they are, and, you know, so they play on that a lot. Yes. Yeah, well, that's something important indeed.
Yeah. So you've touched on the relationship between the Mongols and their Russian subjects. But even though the Horde occupied much of the territory that becomes what we now think of as Russia and in the 20th century, the Soviet Union, including Siberia and the Central Asian republics, the way that Russian historians in particular have treated that period of Russian history has been somewhat influential in the way that the Horde has been perceived, not only in Russian history, but also in other European languages. In particular is the grappling with the fact that not only were the Mongols foreign, they were also Muslim. But as with other aspects of Mongol scholarship, this is starting to evolve now, and I am going to quote you here, which is, you said that the question now is not how Russia survived the Horde, but how the Horde helped to create modern Russia. So how does this new evolving understanding begin to clarify this historical relationship between the Horde and what becomes Russia afterwards?
Well, yeah, that's something also that I really wanted to work on, this very important relationship with what we call Russia today, but from the Middle Ages, we would call Russia more like Russian principalities. There are a lot of political fragmentation, although there are also some ideas of, you know, cultural unity. At the same time, my idea in this book was certainly not to focus on the Russian principalities, but I had really to analyze the fact that the Russian were probably one the most important subjects for the Mongols of the Horde, and the Horde's really the rulers, the Jurchid rulers, were really for them was really important that the Russian princes were remain at peace, that they pay tribute, but also that they, you know, remain productive, they remain they integrated them into the wider trade network of Eurasia, even and especially in the Islamic Central Asian trade networks, and they really want to really try even to force them to force the Russian to accept new trade rules, so they were very important. At some point for the Mongols, they became really important, the Russians. And this appears, I mean, not immediately in the 13th century, but at the end of the 13th century, it became clear that, you know, the Mongols really were really interested in what was happening in the Russian principalities. And also, I think it was made clear by a few scholars well before me that the Mongols were really enabled, in a way, the rise of the House of Moscow, that they really, that they took part in the creation in the Danilovich dynasty, that they supported Alexander Nevsky and, you know, other important princes of the House of Moscow, and that actually what we call the Mongol yoke. So this very negative image of the Mongol domination of Russia was developed later on, much later than in the 13th, 14th century, probably mainly in the, it started only at the end of the 15th century and in, rather in the 16th and 17th centuries. And this was really, I mean, we have wonderful publication on that, you know, by Don Ostrowski, by Charles Halperin and others. So I thought that it was really clear. What I really wanted to show in my book is that the Mongols not only changed the, in a way, the political system of the Russian principalities, but it also changed their economic reach. I really wanted to show how they allowed them really to be part of the wider Mongol order, economic order. And I wanted to show that by being part of the Mongol Empire, the Russian benefited a lot. Because they benefited of tax exemptions for, you know, religious elite men, for princes also. And, you know, they could develop a lot of, they could build, you know, stone buildings or, you know, churches and develop their cities. They had really not only, I mean, they had rather good treatment in a way, in that sense. And I thought that it was very important to make it clear for the readers, because this is something that we discuss a lot with among researchers, but it's not always known, you know. And I thought that it was really important to show, not only to say, oh, well, there's a connection, there's a legacy. No, to show where it is, this legacy, you know, where. So there's a political legacy, but there's also an economic legacy, and there's also a cultural legacy. And I mean, it's amazing to see how many construction, how many buildings were, you know, built and financed during the Mongol period in the north, I mean, in northern Russia. So what is northern Russia today? And I really wanted to explain how, I mean, it was important to explain the system behind it. And so I worked in the book a lot on this system of tax exemptions developed and created by the Mongols and developed. And I think that's, that is really a key aspect. And my idea in the book also was to show that, okay, this period that I prefer to call Mongol Exchange and Pax Mongolica, is a period of globalization, clearly, form of globalization. And in this form of globalization, it's important to understand that the north of Eurasia, including what is, you know, the Russian principalities, and including what is Mongolia today and up to northern Europe. And this is, you know, all these areas that we called later on the Hanseatic League. All this area took the lead, and they really, probably the Mongol launched the whole process, but then they really, really took the lead for almost a century. And that's beneficial to the Russians. I really think so. So my idea was, like, you know, to work again in a way on the Silk Roads, but differently, you see, and focus on the north. Yes.
So you also discuss the legacy that the Mongols left on the Central Asian steppe land. You argue that the empire did not abruptly collapse, as one frequently sees asserted in history textbooks, even with the dates, but that its decline was another phase in its constant evolution, one that had a substantial impact on the history of Eurasia. So could you tell us a little more about the Mongol legacy in Central Asia and on the people who remained nomadic?
Yeah, that was also something that I had to struggle with when I wrote the book. It was how to explain the last the last century of the horde and the end of the Mongol Empire, how it transformed, because I read a lot about, you know, dissolution of the Mongol Empire, fragmentation and so on. It was always very negative, but when I was reading the sources of the, you know, for the 15th and 16th centuries, I realized that it was also a time of amazing creativity, political creativity. There were a lot of new things, you know, coming out. So this fragmentation of power was clearly created at the same time, new political imagination, new theories, new option, new possibilities. And I really wanted to show that to the reader, to the fact that, you know, this is, the way we shouldn't see it only as a decline, but we should see also what came out of it. And that was really a challenge and so interesting to work on that. The idea, so that's why I called my last chapter The Younger Brothers, because that's the way they saw themselves. Now the younger generation will take over, you know. So it's I think really important to emphasize this. And for this period, important aspect is the in the sources, the fact that new names of, you know, for community or for people appeared in here and there, especially Uzbek and Kazakh, and later on Tatar became important too. And that's really fascinating to see how all those names, collective names, appeared and what they mean. So the meaning changed, of course, throughout centuries, you know, but it was connected to the history of the horde. So the Jochid history was like a matrix, you know, and you see that in the 15th century something's going on, and there's new shape of power were created, and new names appeared in the sources. So the idea for me was to see how to show also that nomads were still very strong, that even if names changed, or they were, you know, also adaptation, still nomad themselves as, specific powers, you know, this specific regime remained very strong in Central Asia. And I wanted to also to show that. So my idea was to show that this legacy, this Mongol legacy in the West was a legacy for the Russian, certainly for the Ottomans, certainly also for the Lithuanian and for the Poland-Lithuania, but also in Central Asia for new nomadic powers. So I think that it's very important to show that the nomad had this flexibility, this suppleness in their regime to sort of creates, it's like a revival when you think it's over, but no, they just reappeared and they reshaped themselves. And that's a concept was developed by other friends and colleagues, and especially Pekka Hämäläinen in his two books, one on the Comanche and the other one on the Lakota, where it shows also how, you know, these nomadic regime are like, you know, shape-shifting, and how they adapt themselves to new conditions and yet remain what they are, you know, kept something of their identity. So I thought that it was, you know, very, very close to what was to the process also in Central Asia and Western Asia, you know, in this 15th, 16th century. So that's also, I think, something that should be said clearly. And the fact now also that that's where also the concept of Mongol exchange is important, because yes, in a way the horde is over, yes, the Mongol Empire clearly is over, but the legacy of the Mongol exchange is completely there. I mean, the economic legacy and the knowledge exchange, also population exchange, is still, you know, a very, you know, very important at that time. So that's what I wanted to show at the end of the book, really. Yeah.
And I think. I think the whole framing of the book is such a welcome addition because, as you've mentioned a few times, the Mongol legacy, especially in the broader context of Asian history and world history, tends to be emphasized in the what is now China, Iran, Persia, the Islamic world, and the Russian piece is really left out. And it's not just an important piece for people who work on Russia, but also for people who work on world history as a whole, as well as the other regions under Mongol control, because that comparative aspect is, I think it lends really a very new perspective or a different perspective that's worth considering.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's really what I had in mind, because I wanted to show, to bring the horde back into the Mongol Empire, because for a certain period of time was like, you know, the Mongols were actually the empire was the toll-read. So really China, Iran, Azerbaijan, this whole area, they were also interesting studies, of course, on the Chagatai, and they were, but we don't have as so many sources on the center. And then, you know, the horde was, they are nomads and they are a bit different and they have their own, you know, they follow their own course, and I really wanted to bring them back into the story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, what's next for you? What's your next project?
Well, my next project is a major exhibition on the Mongol Empire, actually. So, I'm working on objects. So, we have this plan here in France. So, it will be actually really organized in Nantes. In the museum there, of having a big exhibition on Genghis Khan and the Mongol Empire. And I would like to show through the amazing objects and, you know, archaeological artifacts and miniatures also, how, you know, the spirit of history, how it was rich and how, you know, to show through object the Mongol exchange. Though in this new project, I will really work on this notion of Mongol exchange, and I will really work on the Mongol Empire as a whole, not only on the West. I think that's very, very interesting for me, because it's new. Also, I remain a historian, of course, but I think historians should really work with objects, with, you know, textiles, and we should really talk to art historians and archaeologists, because we really, you know, gain a lot of doing this. And I really wanted to show this also to wider audience through objects, you know, what different objects that were for long attributed to other, you know, to the subject of the Mongols, that they were attributed to Chinese or to Persian, you know, craftsmanship. Now we could show, we will show that they are Mongol, in fact, and that the term itself, it's political, it's connected to a wider culture, it's a new aesthetic language. And what mean being a Mongol, you know, and the Mongol fashion of the 13th up to the end of the 14th century. So I think that's something that, you know, it's going to be very exciting and new for me. That's going to be my new project, yes.
Okay. What's the time frame for...
I think the exhibition will be launched at the end of 2023. And it will last for almost a year, so until the end, almost, or mid, or let's say spring 2024. So, plenty of time for, you know, people to visit and see.
Yeah, and hopefully the borders will all be open again, and we'll be able to travel.
I hope so.
Wonderful. Well, we'll look forward to that definitely. Marie Favreau's book, The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World, is out from the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. It was published in 2021. Marie Favreau, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was, you know, a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.